If you're a tobacco company or an alcohol company that is not up to speed on the industry, you're 5 years behind. And I know that sounds controversial, but this industry is hard enough. And I think that pretty much every single big company is looking at it. And if they're not, they're way behind the curve.
This is The Dime. Dive into the cannabis and hemp industry through trends, insights, predictions, and tangents.
What's up, guys? Welcome back to another episode of The Dime. I'm Brian Fields, and with me, as always, is Kellen Finney. And this week, we've got a very special guest, Scott Grossman of Turning Point Brands. Scott, thanks for taking the time. How are you doing today?
Of course. How you doing, gentlemen?
Doing well. Good to see you. Kellen, how are you doing?
I'm doing really well. Excited to talk to Scott. Really excited to learn about Turning Point's place in the industry and, you know, just hoping to hold the West Coast down over here.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Scott, just for the record, your location, please.
I'm located in Connecticut. I'm actually on the road today in the field, but I spend most of my time in the Northeast.
That's it. Shout out for another East Coaster, Kellen. You are losing the battle. So Scott, for our listeners unfamiliar about you, can you give it a little background about yourself?
Yeah, sure. I head up corporate development at Turning Point, where I lead efforts on M&A and large commercial partnership focused in the cannabinoid space. Just some context on Turning Point. Turning Point is a marketer and distributor of branded consumer products in the active ingredient space. We're led by our core brands such as Zig-Zag, which, as you may know, is a leading and iconic 150-year-old brand in the rolling paper category. High level, Turning Point is about a $450 million revenue business. We sell across both B2B and B2C channels, including over 200,000 C-stores, head shops, dispensaries, and directly to cannabis operators, both on the cultivation side as well in dispensaries.
And kind of picking that apart, cannabis is just one vertical underneath Turning Point's umbrella?
Yeah. So, you know, like I mentioned, you know, Zig-Zag has been around for over a century. I think the joke is that it was a taboo cannabis accessory for most of that time. Turning Point went public in 2016. And, you know, to our credit, you know, we are one of the first public companies certainly listed on the New York Stock Exchange to actively embrace cannabis and deploy capital in several, you know, non-plant touching companies to help fuel growth and really further embed Zig-Zag into, you know, this huge market that we see.
What was that transition like from kind of cannabis being illegal, taboo, to now it's kind of, there's adult recreational in some states. Hemp, of course, is completely legal. Like, how was that kind of transition from a public image perspective?
Yeah, it's a great question. You know, I've been at Turning Point now just over almost about 2 years. Before that, I was a public and private investor on Wall Street, and spent most of my time focused on consumer, retail, hospitality. So I've been investing and been around the cannabis space for a long time and was looking for the right platform to really spread my wings, given, you know, this green wave that we're experiencing. With respect to inside Turning Point, listen, it's been an evolution. Obviously, we're a public company. You know, historically, there's been laws against paraphernalia, et cetera. I think we're way past that. And given the change, both the normalization, the consumer adoption, we're now in 39 states, 21 of which is recreational. It's a $25 billion industry. It's been embraced by a variety of industries, from big tobacco where we sit, to big food, to, you know, big pharma. The conversation gets easier and easier every day. Which is great to see, both as a consumer and advocate of the plant, but also as a professional. Just gives us a lot more flexibility and ability to kind of move around in a very exciting way.
I'm curious to know, from an investment standpoint, when Turning Point talks about the cannabis vertical, obviously early on, it's probably exciting. There's all these unknowns and opportunities. But obviously, as we've seen now with the economic climate that's going on, it's not as advantageous. So have you seen a shifting in the narrative or in the feedback from investors, or has it kind of stayed constant?
With respect to Turning Point's investors?
Yeah.
Yeah. So like I said, Zig-Zag is roughly half of Turning Point's revenue. It's over almost two-thirds of our cash flow and EBITDA. you know, Zigzag, when we went public in 2016, was relatively flat. And to the points which I just made, you know, we've put a real effort to try and grow Zigzag and make it what is potentially one of the only few nationally recognized cannabis brands in the country. So when we went public in 2016, since 2019 to today, the Zigzag brand has grown 75%. Obviously, a lot of that is tied to the secular wave that we're seeing. And so with respect to our investors, you know, we're viewed as a picks and shovels brand, a valued strategic partner, clearly have, you know, our toes in the water with respect to directly investing in the space. And from, you know, our investor standpoint, it's there are very few companies and industries today that have these secular tailwinds, which we're enjoying. And we're just trying to do the best to help monetize that.
Sure. And I know one of the areas that you enjoy is playing offense from an M&A perspective. Is there certain characteristics for companies you're looking for, especially now, given how the industry is operating?
That is a great question. You know, one of the things that I was tasked in doing when I joined, a lot of it was doing more of an education and getting the management team as well as the board of directors, you know, up to speed on this market, because it's grown so quickly and it's really hard to keep track of. And so, you know, what I would tell you is that we invest based on our best view of what we think the end state could be. We're not financial investors. And so therefore, we're not investing for the next, call it 3 to 5 years. But really, we have to make bets for, you know, almost a perpetual capital duration. And so what that forced us to do is really, you know, what do we want to be when we grow up? And, you know, we took a page from, you know, what we've done in really the big tobacco side. We own a brand called Stoker's, which is a leading value brand in the moist snuff and chewing tobacco space. And so we've never grown tobacco and we've never run retail. And so it really forced us to be really strict upon, you know, like, what do we want to do in cannabis? And so that actually cleared a lot of the chessboard. We knew we didn't want to be an MSO. We knew we didn't want to be a cultivator. And at the same time, we also knew that we didn't want to run dispensaries. Now, never say never, but that really forced us to be a little bit more focused on trying to find areas where we can find opportunities that are highly synergistic with what we do, namely Zigzag and the product portfolio there, but also find ways, whether it's on the brand side, whether it's on the value-added supplier side and the distribution side, to be a valued partner to a variety of people who are already in the space.
So you said you guys kind of like cleared the chessboard, right? And you mentioned a couple really important pieces in the entire industry. And those pieces are valuable for the industry as a whole from a supply chain perspective. Mm-hmm. So are you guys doing anything specific to at least understand those sections of the supply chain? Is there any activities that you kind of participate to help with that?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think one of the big parts of my job is really just being a student and really learning as much as I can throughout the value chain, from breeders to cultivators to best-in-class MSOs to small state operators. I do my best to be in the field like I'm doing now, to really understand exactly what's happening inside the dispensary. And that serves a few purposes. One, the industry is moving so quickly. And so, you know, I can go into a grow room, and I'm actually did it today, you know, finding out the new technologies, whether it's crop steering or new sensors that didn't exist 6, 9, 12 months ago. And so that's only beneficial to what I do by trying to be a student and hopefully an expert in the space. I can then not only have that connectivity, but just deeply understand to the best I can where ultimately the industry is going.
And a lot of that has to be connected on relationships. And I know that's really paramount for you and something you hold really true. So can you kind of share more about how you take that information and those relationships and you help kind of bring that value to your current role?
Yeah, sure. So I think a good example is potentially using one of our portfolio companies. not to pick one, everyone's baby looks, everyone says their baby looks the prettiest, but you know, one of our babies is Old Pal. Old Pal, as you probably know, was one of the pioneers in the asset light model, the licensing model. Clearly very synergistic with Zigzag. They use all of our papers for the pre-rolls and the roll your own. They don't touch the plant, and they're in, you know, call it 9 states today. And so they have connectivity and relationships and partners across the country. And so, you know, I think that's a good example of trying to, you know, one of the big themes that I've been harping on both internally as well as externally to this extent I can is this concept of partnerships and collaborations. I don't necessarily think there's one operator out there that has the silver bullet to do everything exceptionally perfect. And so we're definitely seeing a more receptivity across the value chain to work with partners to solve other people's problems, and in doing so, solving our own. So Old Pal is a good example where we are obviously invested in them. We distribute all of their apparel and their accessory side. And given, you know, that our product's in their end product, we have a number of fruitful conversations across the value chain to not only grow Old Pal, but also grow Zigzag at the same time.
Sure. And kind of expanding on that, a lot of the relationships, are they equity ownership where your team takes ownership in it, or is it just distribution assets in order to help grow their share? How does that work?
We do both. So Old Pal is an equity and debt investment, but Clipper, as a good corollary, is we have the exclusive distribution rights in North America, both in US and Canada. Clipper is, as you may know, is a number one reusable lighter. They have a 20 to 40% market share in Western Europe, where they're founded, in Spain. They have a very small market share in the United States, roughly around 3% behind the number one player, which is BIC. So in that case, you know, we don't have an equity investment in Clipper, but it's really doing what we do day in and day out. We, like I mentioned, we're over 200,000 stores. We have 150 people on the street day in and day out, both in head shops all the way through dispensaries. And so we're trying to push and build not only our brands, but also our partner brands.
Are those kind of relationships strategic? Like you guys get together and you're like, hey, Clipper has got a great market share in Europe. Would they be a great partner? Or is it something that kind of more naturally falls together, like you're like, oh, we both are in the same category, like maybe we should dance together, we're both going to the dance? Kind of walk us through that that process, if you will.
Yeah, it's also a phenomenal question. Obviously there's a ton of accessories out there, and so we have to be very strategic in how we approach it. Obviously everyone's time is very precious. You know, Clipper, you know, by owning the lighter, it's very synergistic with rolling papers and roll your own and pre-rolls. The brand's been around for over 100 years. So there's that nostalgic, iconic type of brand equity, which we understand deeply well. You know, what I would say is, you know, Clipper historically has relied on rolling paper distributors in Europe. And so there was a playbook that they've been deploying in Europe that they wanted to bring in the United States. They were with two previous partners before us, and hopefully we can just do a little bit of a better job to get them further embedded in a much larger market. It's about a $500 million category in the United States. We think it's a $100 million opportunity. Don't know when, but you know, we started selling that product in Q3 of last year. We got it in already into 25,000 stores. And so without question, it's one of the most successful launches, that Turning Point that we've turned on.
I'll be honest, I did not know of Clipper lighters maybe like 14 months ago. And I have no idea if Turning Point is responsible for this. It's just a natural coincidence. But I do know of Clippers now. And it's because dispensaries in Colorado, they literally give out Clipper. And I was like, what is this? And then someone explained that they're reusable and the whole story. So that's a recent development in my life. So I don't know if it's because of your guys' efforts, but I just wanted to give you a shout out.
Thank you. I have nothing to do with it. But yeah, I mean, Clipper is a big brand in the alternative space. Alternative to us, just so we're clear, is, you know, anything but C-stores, you know, head shops, smoke shops, vape shops, dispensaries. The Clipper, besides the reusability, it has the Flint comes out, which helps as a packing tool. A lot of consumers use the Edge to help with joints and the rolling of that. It's a great product. They're also very customizable. So a lot of dispensaries and head shops put their own logos on it. And so it's been a success so far, and we're excited about where we can take it.
Staying on the strategy side, obviously with the M&A is a big focus for you. Are you looking for specific add-on products that fit into the portfolio from a consumer standpoint, as in this consumer likes to smoke, we're looking for products that are all about them? Or are you targeting certain regions, knowing the Northeast is coming online, the Southeast in the future, and looking for certain products that fit in those categories? How do you think about each of those?
Yeah, so with respect to geography, we pay very close attention to what states are being greenlit, when they're coming online, and we divert a lot of our sales force efforts into trying to be a good partner into, you know, getting those head shops and alternative stores to look like the best world class dispensaries, whether it's in California, et cetera. That would be more on the geography. We don't necessarily invest specifically on that. With respect to categories, I would say everything is fair game. You know, 99% of the stuff we look at, unfortunately, we turn down for a variety of reasons. But, you know, we're trying to find something that, you know, really fits with what we do, that can be put into the sales bag and so be a little bit more of a one-stop shop for the customer. And the customer in this case would be the store owner or the MSO or the head shop owner. And so that's kind of how we approach it.
Do you guys have any data that, so like within Zig-Zags, there's different types of rolling papers, correct? Like there's larger ones, there's smaller ones, and I'm generalizing, right? But do you guys have any data where specifically in different geographic regions, you notice that, hey, larger papers sell better in the Northeast? And so then do you guys kind of integrate that into your strategic like launch when a state comes online?
Yeah, I for sure. For sure. I personally do not have, you know, I'm not really deep in that data day in and day out. You know, one of the things that we've done over the last couple of years, like 2019, we launched cones. 2022, we launched, natural leaf wraps. So the portfolio of Zig-Zag is getting larger, from anywhere from different size cones to different types of rolling papers, king size, unbleached, hemp. We have terpene wraps. And so right now, the industry, roughly speaking, 40% is flower, 20% is pre-roll. And the reality is that there's just a number of different use cases for that flower. Some people like to use glass. Some people like to use vape. And so we're trying to figure out the product suite to satisfy all different types of user experiences.
I thought you were going to say 30% beverage and just make a lot of people angry.
I'm bullish on beverage. I think it's less than, 1-3% of the market today. I think there's definitely an argument. If you kind of unwrap the industry today, there's clearly a portion of the market that will never combust, right? They don't want to smoke a joint. And so as you think about consumption lounges, as you think about the more of a normalization of the actual end product, the THC product, I think, all the above, for the industry to grow to what we think it will, there's no question in my mind that beverage will be part of that equation.
I think that's a great transition to the cannabis tobacco overlap. The cannabis industry seems to have a big distrust for tobacco. Would you find that true? And do you have any rebuttal on why that shouldn't be accurate?
I mean, I think as a industry, and I obviously I'm in it, so there's reticence to get in bed with big tobacco, big food, big pharma. They tend to be big companies. I don't necessarily think we're definitely not enemies. I think at worst, we're frenemies, right? You've seen a number of things, whether what we've done or BAT, or Altria with Cronos, there's been a bunch of like toe dipping from a number of big tobacco. With us, I think it's a little bit of an easier sell, right? Because we've been in the rolling paper business now for a very long time. And at the end of the day, it comes down to trusting and knowing your partners, doing what you say you're going to do. And so I think it's a little bit easier for us. But at the end of the day, I think that this whole strategic first startup mentality is always, whether you're in cannabis or not, there's always that fear that you're getting in bed with a much larger company. And then I think over time that that will fall away. At least that's my hope.
Yeah, I think so, 100%. And I think synergies is a big, big add-on advantage, right? The resources that a tobacco company can bring to the table is just massively advantageous. They've done it at large scale, which is critical, right? As the game evolves from, like, let's call it independent market to market and becomes a global game, you're going to need resources and infrastructure that just isn't currently seen here in cannabis that can be utilized that are already in place from tobacco companies.
That's fair. That's completely fair. And if you look at big, you know, big tobacco specifically, you know, that industry is fragmented as well, right? There are people who grow it, there are people who package it, and there are people who sell it. Ultimately, I think that's where our industry is going as well. And this kind of speaks to being world-class at exactly what you do and staying focused. And so over time, I think that, you know, these companies are going to need partners, whether to getting the products on the shelves or marketing it in the right way or producing it in the right way. It's really hard to do everything great, which is what I said before.
Scott, do you have any partners outside of the cannabis industry that are interested in getting inside that say, hey, Scott, you know, what do you think about bringing product X or infrastructure Y into the cannabis industry? Is the feeling and the outside industry of getting warmer and being interested in learning more and then potentially partnering in the space?
When you say outside industry, can you be a little bit more specific?
Sure. So like more specific tobacco-based companies that are not currently partnering with cannabis companies or more not necessarily operating within cannabis currently, but more interested in learning about it and then dipping the toe inside, like you were saying.
Yeah, this is going to be controversial, but if you're a tobacco company or an alcohol company that is not up to speed on the industry, you're 5 years behind. And I know that sounds controversial, but this industry is hard enough. And I think that pretty much every single big company is looking at it. And if they're not, they're way behind the curve. Like I said, my past, you know, the reason why I ultimately decided to go all in is that I was on the board of a small beverage company that was had nothing to do with cannabis, of course, but they were looking at hemp-derived and THC. And, you know, I mentioned, I was an investor in mostly bigger companies. And I would tell you that the information inside the boardroom of a big food company on cannabis today is light years ahead of where it was, call it 3 to 5 years ago. And that's for a number of reasons. One, I think it's potentially cannibalizing their core business. But also, you know, if you're a distributor of alcohol or et cetera or soda, this only adds to the sales bag and it's somewhat of an easier sell for a bigger company. And so I think we're only going to see that increase.
I 100% agree. And I don't think it's controversial at all. And I think the people who believe that's controversial are just maybe lacking with understanding of what the current times are. Because if your role is to be head of strategy of one of these large companies and you're not thinking about cannabis as a possible add-in, probably doing a disservice to your company because it is a massive opportunity, one that needs capital, infrastructure, and resources desperately. And it's just a matter of time before the walls come down and the bigger players are here operating. So if you don't have that strategy ready to roll, probably going to be behind.
Yeah, and not only the actual end product. You know, a good example is what we did with Amiri last year. We did a partnership with Amiri, which is a high-end clothing brand, and we created Zigzag Amiri products that we're selling for, you know, $500 t-shirts. And I think that's a really good example of cannabis crossing across different parts of pop culture, whether it's in the concert space or the event planning space or the advertising space. The cannabis consumer is very different than when it was 10, 15, 20 years ago. And whether you do anything or not actual on the product side, I think knowing, you know, the what's going on inside the industry is only going to be beneficial to what you do day in and day out.
Yeah, and it's also beneficial to a lot of these cannabis companies that probably just don't know it yet, right? Because they don't need to reinvent the wheel, right? Like a lot of this infrastructure and relationships and all these other things are already present. It's just a matter of getting two parties to agree on terms and be able to kind of utilize like the infrastructure that's already present.
Yeah, exactly. And just going back to what I just said, it might not be a traditional partnership or investment. It might be XYZ product is selling in Saks, but is trying to target that consumer who's more prone to using cannabis versus alcohol. You know, so there are a bunch of ways. I think, you know, on the concert side, you're seeing it more, you know, whether it's Outland Bands or Lollapalooza. There's been a huge outreach on amongst these types of companies to try and market to these consumers. So that's pretty exciting. And I still think we're very early, but I only see it going increasing.
I know your team is not a plant touching operator, but does it face any cannabis related issues or stigmas that would surprise or shock other people to hear?
Listen, I think we all face the same stigma. You know, cannabis consumers are lazy, or they're not motivated, or, you know, I'm probably biased, but, you know, it could be further from the truth. And the most consumers that I know who use it recreationally or medically are super high performers, you know? I think that we're living in a world where health and wellness is being closely examined from everything we put in our body. And I'm not saying that cannabis is the end all be all and it's the panacea to longevity. But if you're drinking 5 beers at a night and spending $50 and have 1,000 calories and waking up with a hangover, the younger generations are seeking alternatives. And so I think the stigma that was perpetuated over the last 50 plus years is just a shame. And I'm glad to see that changing.
100%. On other podcasts, I've heard you mention dispensaries 2.0. I'd like to know what you mean by that.
Yeah. So at the end of the day, dispensary 2.0 is very similar to what we see in every other type of industry. You walk into a Whole Foods or a CVS or a Walgreens, you traditionally see 80 or 70 to 90% being branded products, and the rest being private label. You have shelves where the high end or the premium is right in front of your eyes, and the lower end or the value is on the bottom end. I'm thinking of cereal, which is a great category to look at.
Crazy.
Dispensary 2.0 just basically means the ability to target a different consumer, a different demographic, and a different user experience. The example that I use is if I'm having 20 people over my house for a party or a barbecue, I'm probably not serving Dom Perignon to all 20 people. Whereas if I go out with my wife, then, you know, that purchase may be different. And I think that's ultimately what I mean by dispensary 2.0. And part of that equation is having world-class brands like Zig-Zag being a part of that experience.
How do we get there, and how do other brands rise to that world class that you shared?
Yeah. So, you know, I would say cannabis 1.0, and this is somewhat hard to hear. I think we just had too many brands. They weren't delivering a value proposition. They weren't consistent. A lot of them were Me Too brands. And that made it very hard for brands to stand out. I think it also made it very hard and confusing to the end consumer. And then if you're an operator or an MSO or an SSO, it also made it very hard to kind of pick the winners versus the potential losers. There's a natural attrition going on. Obviously, capital is extremely tight, and that's not just in cannabis, but we're seeing it across other startups. And so the strong, in my opinion, are getting stronger throughout the value chain, by the way. And so if you're a world-class brand and you're in your particular state and have proven the ability to expand and penetrate other states and see the user gravitate towards that, I think ultimately that's how we get there, is just having the cream rise to the top and having the best operators understand the power of brands and have companies like Turning Point who can distribute and market and sell those brands. I think that's ultimately going to take time, but that's ultimately how we think the end state looks like.
How far do you think we are from these products just being available in your everyday retail locations?
cannabis products?
Yeah. I know Zigzag's already available, but.
Oh, yeah. I think we're a far, far cry from that.
I'm having like an aisle in my local grocery store of just cannabis products. You think we're a little ways away?
Minnesota feels differently.
Yeah, I mean, we have a patchwork of states, all with their own rules. Every state is its own market. We have infrastructure in every state. If you're an operator and, you know, poured millions of dollars to build that, you're clearly going to be reluctant to have cannabis be sold in, you know, in a 7-Eleven. Yeah. On the flip side, if you're a 7-Eleven, you want to get those products in the store because your customers are going elsewhere. You know, I don't necessarily know. My sense is federal legalization will have a huge impact on ultimately what that looks like, but I had clearly have no idea when or when that could happen.
One if of you my do, let me know. That'd be
sick. We edit that part out, so we just keep it between us. One of my favorite things to do is when a friend of mine shows me a product they purchased from a regional dispensary, I always like to ask them, why did you buy that product, right? Solely because I'm curious, just like you were saying, Scott, like how does someone select first time which brand to take? And two responses are overwhelmingly the favorites. One, the bud tender recommended it.
Yep.
Second one, I like the packaging. And it just blows my mind that those are the two fundamental choices when people are making choices, because it's so difficult for brands to put on this incredible product and know literally random choice based on color association and packaging and a bud tender recommendation. So, I mean, how do brands overcome those challenges?
Yeah, it's hard. I don't have that. I don't have a magic bullet. I would also put on that list is THC concentration,
sure,
which is just a shame because, you know, we don't buy alcohol that way. Maybe when we were younger and stupid, we bought Everclear because it had, you know, a bang for your buck. But, you know, anyone who's been consuming cannabis and is passionate about it knows that THC percentage means nothing. Clearly, the terpene content and the way it's handled and grown and what type of substrate it's grown in and how it's cured, it matters more. You know, there's this whole concept of power users. Power users are exactly what you think it means. It's those consumers who are, I wouldn't call them connoisseurs, but more regulars. And they're, call it 20 to 30% of the market, but they buy a lot more. And so that tends to be more on the focused on quality. Now, every state's different, right? So a quality product in California, again, my humble opinion is still light years ahead of most states. And so I think over time that does shake out. But to your point, I think for a brand to really resonate, it has to be consistent. It has to be priced effectively. And the consumer feels like they're getting value for it. But it also has to be innovative. And to your point, it has to look different. And it has to speak to that consumer. So all the above, not easy. But ultimately, I think, you know, there are a few brands that have been able to do some of that, you know, not to pick on names, but I think Cookies has done a really good job. A couple of hash companies like 710, you know, Jungle Boys on the flower side. There are a few companies that have really been able to demonstrate a particular brand ethos and a consistency of product to back it up. And ultimately, it just takes reps and time to build brand equity and customer awareness.
Thoughts on sativa, hybrid, and indica?
You know, it's, I think everything at this point is a hybrid. You know, when I'm aging myself, but I'm 45 years old, and the sativa indica conversation really didn't exist 10 years ago. It's a relatively new phenomenon. I think everything at this point is hybridized and has a blend of each. I personally, you know, I don't enjoy sativa leaning heavy strains. It's just not the effect that I'm looking for. I tend to use it for sleep and for relaxation. And so I understand the nomenclature. I understand that you have to kind of put something on the shelf that speaks to it, again, a different experience. But I think at this point, to say something is pure sativa or pure indica is a little bit of a misnomer.
How do you think consumers will purchase products in the future then?
In terms of strain, was that meaning?
Yeah, like right now it seems like to be the leading indicator. I bought this indica because the bud tender recommended it, because I was looking for something like this. How do you think consumers will purchase products in the future? Something differently, or do you think it'll be sativa, indica, and hybrid will stay?
It's a good question. I don't necessarily know if I have a great answer to that. I think most people who go to the budtender are looking for a particular experience, right? I have a lot of pain. Can you help with this? Or I can't sleep. Can you help with that? And so my suspicion is certainly over the next, call it 3 to 10 years, is that we'll still be using that dialogue. My hope and expectation is that as we do more work on the cannabinoids and as well as the terpenes, we'll have a better ability to dial in the particular experience that the consumer is looking for. And that's probably the next chess move, is just having more information on what terpenes do to us, more information on the minor cannabinoids, again, to address a certain experience. That's my hope. And we're starting to see that. You know, you're definitely seeing a couple of things. A couple of brands are just moving away from the sativa hybrid and saying this is for sleep or relaxation or energy or workout. And so it's definitely more of an experience-based type of product. On the other hand, we're also starting to see just an increased emphasis on what actually is inside this strain. So the best, you know, on the super high quality side, you know, I think genetic integrity is becoming way more important. You know, how did we actually create the strain? This was an F2 seed that was pollinated and going back to the original. I think people, particularly on the power user side and the high quality side, really want to know exactly what's inside the strain. But also, you're also seeing people saying, you know what, I just want to get a good night's sleep. I don't care what's in it. If it works, fantastic. And so I think all the above, which is challenging because you have to kind of satisfy all those consumers. But I think all the above is likely going to happen.
Yeah, I agree. And I will say one thing. There is an organization out of California, they're manufacturing, or they're trying to put together what are called terpene tags. I was going to bite my tongue, but I was like, I have to.
You got to send an invoice to Dr. Abrams.
I know. I need to.
Sponsored the podcast.
Advertising the podcast.
Yeah,
I literally was debating mentioning it or not because, no, but they're doing good work. They ran a huge study on several terpenes and how individuals respond to those strains based on the terpenes. They correlated it and they're putting together a product called terpene tags that is supposed to address everything you just said, Scott, right? Like, these are the terpenes that are present that cause this effect. So when you go and purchase a plant, right, or some flower, at least you have some science that you can stand on instead of Joe in his closet grew this from these two strains that he was told that were this, and now it's an indica, right? Yeah. So it's a step in the right direction, but I do think that that's the next move for the power users. But I also think it's really important for mass adoption, right? For more of these like other consumers that are curious, right? If they're able to be like, okay, there is some scientific reasoning to why this product helps me sleep, they're going to be more willing to try it than kind of these anecdotal stories that they're hearing, in my opinion, at least.
I agree. Certainly on the medical side, right?
Yes.
If you're thinking about replacing Ambien with a gummy, you're certainly going to want to know, you know, how they stack up against each other. So I'm all in favor of that. I'm all in favor of also genetic integrity. It's no secret that as you continue to stress these mothers and the clones, the integrity of the plant just kind of breaks down. And so those, you know, those growers who, you know, have a passion for trying to create strains that are fresh and new just tend to be healthier and, you know, tend to be more potent. And so those are very encouraging signs.
Is there a specific, so like, stabilizing crops sounds like something the tobacco industry has probably already, they probably tackled that obstacle 100+ years ago, correct? So is there something that Turning Point can look back in their history and be like, okay, we watched this kind of thing play out when they were trying to stabilize different tobacco strains, right? Is there something like that that you guys are looking at historically, or is that just kind of...
Not specifically what I'm focused on. I think that what's going on in crop steering now with sensors is fascinating to me. And ultimately, there's decades of ag tech that's at the industry's disposal to apply to this plant, right? I mean, at the end of the day, it's an agricultural product. You know, BRICS testing and trying to understand, you know, how the pH content of these plants is changing. All of that's happening in real time, literally. And, you know, I think that's certainly, you know, obvious in hindsight, but also very exciting because I think it's allowing the grower to really dial in what they're trying to achieve and ultimately trying to get higher yield and higher quality. And so with respect to tobacco, I don't have the information. I don't necessarily know, and I certainly can find out for you what they've done. You know, that product is a little bit more refined, right? It's one tobacco plant and they break it down. And so it's a little bit of a different, it's not necessarily apples and oranges, but I think the same philosophy would apply.
I think pulling from the ag tech space is so critical. And we've seen a big shift in how that works. And I think for some, it's kind of been shocking. And others, they're kind of unaware of that all this technology exists. But think about it. All these other industries that have been around for hundreds and hundreds of years utilize the same principles. We can apply that technology internally and have massive benefits probably pretty easily.
Yeah, I agree. I think some of the things that we're seeing is just amazing, right? I mean, we're seeing grows now just literally have, you know, five plants in a row now are three and producing, you know, better quality and more yield. Light technology, soil technology, feed technology, all of this stuff is, again, some of it's off the shelf and just hasn't been applied in this industry. And just given the growth in the industry and the number of people that are now in it, it's becoming a legitimate industry. And that's only natural to have and apply things that already exist, whether it's for tomatoes or blueberries or raspberries, and apply it to this. So that's all exciting. But there's also new stuff that we have yet to pioneer and apply it specifically to this industry. I'm speaking specifically to the curing side and the trim side, and you know how we're creating manufactured products, whether it's a pre-roll or a gummy. You know, all that innovation is kind of happening in real time. And again, it kind of speaks to just staying on top of it, having your finger on the pulse.
What's the future roadmap?
For me or for the company?
Either or.
Yeah, listen, I mean, I think the industry is clearly going through a tumultuous time. I think when we got hit with inflation really in Q2 of last year, combined with price compression now across the country, it just became a very challenging environment for operators. At the same time, we're seeing continued consumer adoption, continued state expansion. What's unclear right now is that it seems that we're in a much more challenging macro environment outside of cannabis. Cost of capital is higher. You know, we talk a lot about internally what's going on in the regional banks. The ability to get access to capital is harder. And so all those pressures on traditional companies is only going to make it that much harder for cannabis companies. I think the roadmap is continuing to do what we're doing. With respect to Turning Point, we're head down. We're very much focused on trying to get our products that people love and have loved for 150 years in more hands and more stores. So we're going to continue to do what we do well. And in terms of the roadmap of the industry, I think it's just too early to tell. I think we're going to see, again, the strong getting stronger, balance sheet over income statement, and hopefully getting some reform on the Hill to enable these companies to really thrive and grow again. But in the getting to that point is a little uncertain. And I think asking anyone that question who has a crystal ball, it's suspicious because it could go in a lot of different ways.
When you got started in the cannabis journey, what did you get right? And most importantly, what did you get wrong?
What did I get right? I got right that it would be a state-led issue. I got right that the pressure on bordering states to accelerate the adoption in their own state would increase. I got right that this would cross the aisle between red and blue. And I got right that the industry would start to become more normal and start eating a bunch of established businesses launch. What I got wrong, I don't think the price compression, anyone underwrote that. I think that's been way deeper than most have anticipated. I also thought that access to capital and the ability for more institutional investors as well as other strategics, I thought at this point we'd have more at the table, and we don't. That's probably how I would answer that question.
Before we do predictions, we ask all of our guests, if you could sum up your experience in a main takeaway or lesson learned to pass on to the next generation, what would it be?
Oof. I would say take care of yourself. I think we spend a lot of time, everyone's hustling and trying to be their best, but I don't think we spend enough time about, you know, what you need to do in order to be prepared for that journey. So whether it's meditation or working out and eating right, I would definitely say that if you're 30 years old and you're not working out 2 to 3 times a week, I think you're going to get lapped. So that would be probably a different answer than you're used to, but I definitely think that's something I'm super passionate about and I like to pass along towards the younger generations. With respect to work, you know, at the end of the day, this is a relationship-driven business. It's really small and reputation matters enormously. And so what I would say is do what you say you're going to do. And if you can't or something's changed, just be super transparent and just try to foster relationships wherever you go. And if there's nothing to do with that particular party, don't burn that bridge, because you never know when that person's going to emerge in a different role. You never know when that company is going to be an opportunity down the road. And so I just try to hold myself with enormously high integrity and respect for anyone across the aisle, and just try and be a good partner. And if I can't help them directly, try and find someone who can.
It's really well said. All right, prediction time.
Oh, God.
That is an easy one. Scott, do you think the cannabis and tobacco industry will become one macro industry and eventually merge? If so, when? If not, why not?
Like become the same industry? So like an Altria, Marlboro selling cannabis? Or yeah, I think it's going to be a hybrid. I definitely think they're going to be standalone, very large, successful cannabis-only companies. I definitely see a world where I'm hedging a little bit, clearly. I definitely see a world where cannabis becomes part of a broader portfolio, whether that's big food, big tobacco, big pharma. And we've already seen that. So I don't think I'm going on a ledge with that. But to say that the tobacco industry is going to become cannabis, I don't think it's correct.
You didn't like Boris Jordan's statement on that?
What did he say?
I think he said the moment legalization happens, that tobacco companies will become cannabis companies.
I think it'll be part of the portfolio.
As it should be.
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, what's not necessarily always appreciated is, you know, a lot of these businesses are enormously moated. So if you're a big tobacco selling into a C-store, you have very valuable shelf space. You have very valuable distribution and relationships. And so to add a product that people now want, as opposed to things that people don't want, i.e. combustible cigarettes, just makes a lot of sense. Similarly, if you're distributing alcohol or you're a bud house and you're making that pit stop, it just makes a lot of sense there. So I definitely think that they're synergistic and some cases cannibalizes what they're doing now. But in many cases, at least in our case, it just expands the opportunity that's in front of you.
Yeah. Kellen.
I think they merge. And my reasoning is partially due, I think we were talking before Scott jumped on, and back in my college days, I was thinking about how to describe this story. Back in my college days, part of the tradition or routine when me and my buddies got together to consume cannabis was we were talking about zigzags, right? And instead of zigzags, we were using blunt wraps, right? Mm-hmm. Which are tobacco based. And so I know that spliffs are really big in Europe, right? I know a lot of friends that consume spliffs on a regular basis. I think that in probably 10 plus years, it'll be more than 10 years probably, but I'm going to say in 10 years that you'll be able to go to a store and purchase a pre-roll that has both tobacco leaf and cannabis leaf in it. You'll be able to go purchase a pre-rolled blunt with an actual tobacco blunt or tobacco leaf, I guess you could say, right? Is the best way to say that. So I do think they're going to merge. I don't think that tobacco companies will be cannabis companies. Maybe one or two might rebrand if they have a poor public image right now and they want to just kind of wipe that public image and then rebrand as a cannabis company to raise money or play some game like that. But that's my kind of opinion on the matter. I think that they've been together for a while and now they're kind of come out of the closet and let everyone know that they had been there together officially, but it won't happen for 10 years.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I think timing, going back to what I got wrong, I think timing in this industry is just
impossible.
Super hard to predict. But I think what you just mentioned is there's definitely an end state that looks like that for sure.
All right. So since Kellen said yes and you took the hybrid approach, I will say no. I don't think that they'll ever be able to become one because I think that tobacco has a solid reputation with DC. And I think that while we can all agree that the people who make decisions probably don't know what's best for the people who are making them, there'll be a hard stance against not allowing tobacco to be involved in certain areas while we've seen the overlap. But I think they'll put a line in the sand and they'll say, okay, with legalization, X can happen, and they'll try to keep tobacco on the side in order to prevent big tobacco from coming in and kind of leading the industry. Whether or not I think that's best is different, but I don't think, given how we've laid things out today, that the industry will eventually become one. I do think, like you guys said, that the certain tobacco companies will add that into their portfolio, but I think they'll have to have different assets separately and some creative accounting and nice business form in order to keep them separate, but also together.
Yeah, that's also fair. That's hence my hybrid approach.
Yeah, well, you left me with no choice. So Scott, for our listeners, they want to get in touch and they want to learn more about Turning Point Brands, where can they find you?
Yeah, sure. Turningpoint.com. That's the best way to find out a little bit more about our company. Zigzag.com is our B2C site. You could also find us on Amazon. Obviously, look at us throughout the entire retail network. With me specifically, I tend to be pretty active on Twitter. It's SRG444, I believe, or maybe one more four, but there's only one SRG444. So that's me. And please reach out. Happy to talk to anyone and learn about what people are doing. And it's exciting. And again, to the extent that I can help, I'd be happy to talk.
Awesome. This was fun. We'll link it up in the show notes. Thanks for taking the time.
You bet. Thanks for inviting me, guys.
Guys, if you've enjoyed this podcast over the last few years, can you please take 3 minutes or less and leave us a quick review on Apple or Spotify? All reviews make a massive difference for us and help other people like you find this podcast. From the bottom of our hearts, thank you.
Thanks for listening to today's show. To check out more great cannabis podcasts, go to podconnects.com. Here's a preview of one of our other shows.
I'm Larry Mishkin, and I'd like to invite you to join Rob Hunt and me on our weekly podcast, The Deadhead Cannabis Show. Each week, we explore the latest cannabis and jam band news and reminisce with other deadheads and jam band lovers about the great musical acts that we've seen and heard. Check out a new episode every Monday.